This is Taking Aim with
Rob Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, The Grand Chessboard, 11 Years Later, Part 3, Global Hegemony and Permanent War. In 1997, when Zbigniew Brzezinski wrote The Grand Chessboard, American Primacy and Its Geostrategic Imperatives, he referred to Eurasia, the landmass including Europe, Central Asia, Middle East, and Asia itself. This landmass, he noted, accounts for three-quarters of the world's energy resources and three-quarters of the world's population. He started his book by noting that immediately after World War II, the U.S. economy accounted for 50% of the world's gross national product, as the economies of Europe had been devastated. By the end of the Cold War, the U.S. economy had settled back to 30% of the world's gross national product. Brzezinski was concerned with how the U.S. can achieve global hegemony. In order to do that, he notes that it is important to have a huge amount of defense spending. As we noted in Part 2, Brzezinski talks about something essential, such as a new Pearl Harbor. New Pearl Harbor is the phrase that was used later on by the project of New American Century. Brzezinski wrote, "The pursuit of power is not a goal that commands popular passion, except in conditions of a sudden threat or challenges to the public sense of well-being. The economic self-denial that is defense spending and the human sacrifices, casualties, even among professional soldiers, required in the effort are uncongenial to democratic instincts. Democracy is inimical to imperial mobilization." End quote. What Brzezinski states in The Grand Chessboard is that with the breakup of the Soviet Union, a breakup of which he takes chief responsibility in the grand design of how that breakup came about, Brzezinski goes on to say that this offers the United States the opportunity, and in fact it created for the United States a position as the world's one superpower. It opens up for the United States the imperative of preserving a European bridgehead and its expansion as a springboard for, quote, democracy, and that this is relevant to America's security. He notes that there's a central core. That's a swath of land that includes France, Germany, Poland, and the Ukraine. He notes particularly that in the breakup of the Soviet Union, 150 million people were in Russia and 150 million were outside, including 52 million Ukrainians. But of the 150 outside of Russia, 20 million speak Russian. He goes on and describes in The Grand Chessboard what it meant for the Russians. The loss of the Ukraine in 1991 meant the loss of Odessa port on the Black Sea, which had been the USSR's gateway to the Mediterranean and beyond. The loss of Riga and Tallinn in ports in the Baltic states, which had been under Russian control since the 1700s, meant that Russia's remaining Baltic port was one in which there were freezing winters and made it inaccessible part of the year. The collapse of the Warsaw Pact meant that Poland gravitated to NATO and that Russia was suddenly enveloped. But most of all, we have to look at the Caspian Sea and Central Asia. Before the Soviet Union's collapse, Brzezinski writes, the Caspian Sea was a Russian lake with a small southern sector falling within Iran's perimeter. With the emergence of the independent and strongly nationalist Azerbaijan, reinforced by the influx of eager Western oil investors, and similarly an independent Kazakhstan and Turkmenistan, Russia became only one of five claimants to the riches of the Caspian Sea basin. It could no longer confidently assume that it could dispose of these resources on its own. The emergence of the independent Central Asian states meant that Russia's southeastern frontier had been pushed back northward more than 1,000 miles. But what is most significant and what we're going to discuss today on Taking Aim is the wealth of these Central Asian states. What does it mean, not only that the Russian borders were pushed back 1,000 miles, but that these states controlled vast mineral and energy deposits that were bound to attract foreign interests? Ralph?
This idea of the necessity of an external threat as the predicate for the ability to pursue an imperial policy that is essential to the survival of American capitalism is a theme to which Brzezinski returns not only in each subsequent article and position paper and interview that he gives, but within the book, The Grand Chessboard itself. You were citing a passage in which he stated that never before has a populist democracy attained international supremacy. That passage is preceded by the following statement. It is also a fact that America is too democratic at home to be autocratic abroad, and this limits the use of America's power, especially its capacity for military intimidation. Now, it's interesting because this theme is not merely stipulated on page 35, but throughout the book he returns to it. Quote on page 211, "As America becomes an increasingly multicultural society, it will find it more difficult to fashion consensus on foreign policy issues except in the circumstance of a truly massive and widely perceived direct threat." This notion of a new Pearl Harbor, which was picked up by PNAC, the Project for a New American Century, which is reiterated by Condoleezza Rice and articulated as well by Dove Zakheim, of the Pentagon's controller, is not a throwaway comment. It is a central ideological governing rationale for imperialism itself, the engineering of perceived threats to terrorize the American population with major military and attack operations organized by the rulers themselves. Brzezinski's The Grand Chessboard is a very clear document of imperial conquest, but it is as well an extraordinary admission that capitalism in the current era cannot survive without permanent war, that imperial hegemony and empire are the very survival predicate for this system which is in terminal decay. Brzezinski writes, "Ever since the continent started interacting politically some 500 years ago, Eurasia has been the center of world power. It is imperative that no Eurasian challenger emerge capable of dominating Eurasia and thus of challenging the United States. The formulation of a comprehensive and integrated Eurasian geostrategy is the governing purpose of this book. It is how America manages Eurasia that is critical. The power that dominates Eurasia, controlling two of the world's three most advanced and economically productive regions, becomes a necessity. A mere glance at the map suggests that this control over Eurasia will automatically entail Africa's subordination, rendering the Western Hemisphere and Oceania geopolitically peripheral to the world's central continent. 75% of the world's people live in Eurasia. Most of the world's physical wealth is there as well, in its enterprises and underneath its soil. Eurasia accounts for 3/4 of the world's known energy resources," and he continues. On page 125, "The momentum of Asia's economic development is generating massive pressures for the exploration, exploitation, the conquest, in essence, of new sources of energy, and the Central Asian region and the Caspian Sea Basin contain reserves of natural gas and oil that dwarf those of Kuwait, the Gulf of Mexico, or the North Sea. In the long run, global politics are bound to become increasingly uncongenial to the concentration of hegemonic power in the hands of a single state. America is not only the first, as well as the only truly global superpower, but it is likely to be the very last." And he continues with this thesis. It is the imperative for American capitalism to become the permanent and last superpower in the world. Now, I want to take a moment to describe to our brothers and sisters, our listeners, who is Zbigniew Brzezinski? What, indeed, does he represent within the context, the confines of ruling class strategists? He is a counselor for the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He was the national security advisor to Jimmy Carter, President Carter, 1977 to 81. He is a trustee and founder of the Trilateral Commission. He is an international advisor on major U.S. global corporations. He was a close associate of Henry Kissinger. Under Ronald Reagan, he was a key figure in the National Security Council Defense Department Commission on Integrated Long-Term Strategy. And under Ronald Reagan, he was a central member of the President's Foreign Intelligence Advisory Boards, and he is a member of the Board of Directors of the Council on Foreign Relations. He was, in 1988, the co-chairperson of George Bush's National Security Advisory Task Force. That's Bush Sr. So you have the understanding, brothers and sisters, he's a national security advisor to Jimmy Carter. He's on the Trilateral Commission, the American Foreign Policy Institute, the Center for Strategic and International Studies, the Council on Foreign Relations, and he is the past attendee and key presenter at several conferences of the Bilderberger Group, which is described here as a nonpartisan affiliation of the wealthiest and most powerful families and corporations on the planet. That is the context here. Democratic Party, Republican Party, he is the key strategic advisor to Barack Obama, as he was for Jimmy Carter, as he was for Ronald Reagan, as he was for George Bush Sr.
And Ralph Bill Clinton, too.
And Bill Clinton, thank you, Maya. Is there any more clear manifestation of, not, don't call it bipartisan, brothers and sisters, call it the collusion of the two capitalist parties as one strategy apparatus, ruling apparatus, governing facade for capital, for the ruling class within the United States, and for devising the stratagems of imperialism on a permanent basis and the military complement thereof, and as Brzezinski so clearly and passionately articulates, the need to create conditions for direct and essentially totalitarian control of this small corporate and financial elite within the confines of the United States itself. A populist democracy, he says, is incompatible with the necessary imperial design for which capitalism, on which it is dependent, and for which the rulers of this society have to continually press, impose, demand, and implement.
Ralph, the role that Brzezinski plays is very similar to the role of James Schlesinger, who served in the Department of Defense as Defense Secretary in both administrations of the Republican Party and the Democratic Party. And we have here Brzezinski crossing over administrations, too.
Well, what's interesting about Schlesinger, Ma, just to mention this, is that Schlesinger serves for Ford when he's challenged by Reagan, Reagan when he overcomes Ford, for Carter when he is elected president, for each subsequent president, for each competing nominee. It doesn't matter which is the candidate, it doesn't matter which is the party, Schlesinger is the implementer, the servant of all. Just as Joe Biden, who is now the vice presidential candidate under Barack Obama, was a close working associate of Brent Scowcroft, the national security advisor to George Bush Sr., the architect of the first Gulf War. This is a class-conscious cabal who is at the service of ruling capital under the political facade of the two parties, which come down to nothing more than a strategizing coterie for the military-industrial complex of the American ruling class.
Ralph, as much as they paint Joe Biden as a man of the people who comes from Pennsylvania, whose father was a car salesman, they forget that Joe Biden's principal support came from the largest credit card company in the United States, which was taken over by Bank of America.
Yes, MBNA, for which he was a key mouthpiece and spokesperson. It's why Biden was the attack dog for the bankruptcy bill that was passed in 2005, which made it almost impossible for people to declare bankruptcy and to preserve their dwindling assets from being seized by rapacious credit card companies and banks.
Yes, so Joe Biden, no man of the people. And again, let's return to the Brzezinski quote, that the pursuit of power is not a goal that commands popular passion except in conditions of a sudden threat or challenges to the public sense of well-being. Over and again, we must return to that quote. It reinforces everything you are saying, Ralph. Let's look at Brzezinski as the architect of the breakup of the Soviet Union.
Maya, before we do that, and we will come to it immediately, I'm tempted to regale our listeners with a particular story. I had the opportunity, as I've mentioned before in Taking Aim, of spending a lot of time with Joe and Lai over the course of 5 years, particularly when I was involved in negotiating the boundary war between India and China. On the death of Ho Chi Minh, there was a gathering in Hanoi of the leaders of many of the then communist states, and Zhou Enlai was there along with Kosygin, and Kosygin absolutely loathed Zhou Enlai. At one point, Zhou Enlai was confronted by Kosygin, who said, "Here I am, the son and the grandson and the great-grandson of peasants and working people, on the occasion of the funeral of the great proletarian hero Comrade Ho Chi Minh. And you, the scion and descendants of generations of mandarins and the privileged." To which Zhou Enlai responded, "Yes, we each betrayed our class." So indeed has Joe Biden, so indeed do all those who emerge from the ranks of the working population to become spokespersons and mouthpieces for the ruling class. The exchange between Zhou Enlai and Kosygin is a paraphrase and somewhat apocryphal, but expresses the essence of what Zhou Enlai thought of Kosygin and Kosygin of Zhou Enlai, but more importantly illuminates the role of people who emerge from the workers to serve the interests of their masters.
Now, to return to Brzezinski and the imperative of the breakup of the Soviet Union, his goal, U.S. hegemony, imperial hegemony, and the control and seizure of resources. As he states, and as you referred to before, the world's energy consumption is bound to vastly increase over the next 2 or 3 decades. Estimates by the U.S. Department of Energy anticipate that world demand will rise by more than 50% between 1993 and 2015, with the most significant increase in consumption occurring in the Far East. The momentum of Asia's economic development is already generating massive pressures for the exploration and exploitation of new sources of energy, and the Central Asian region and the Caspian Sea Basin are known to contain reserves of natural gas and oil that dwarf those of Kuwait, the Gulf of Mexico, or the North Sea. Until the collapse of the Soviet Union, Brzezinski writes, access to the region was monopolized by Moscow. All rail transport, gas and oil pipelines, and even air travel were channeled through the center. Russian geopoliticians would prefer it remain so, since they know that whoever either controls or dominates access to the region is the one most likely to win the geopolitical and economic prize. It is consideration that has made the pipeline issue so central to the future of the Caspian Sea Basin and Central Asia. If the main pipelines to the region continue to pass through Russian territory to the Russian outlet on the Black Sea at Novorossiysk, the political consequences of this condition will make themselves felt, even without any overt Russian power plays. The region will remain a political dependency, with Moscow in a strong position to determine how the region's new wealth is to be shared. Conversely, if another pipeline crosses the Caspian Sea to Azerbaijan and thence to the Mediterranean through Turkey, And if one more goes to the Arabian Sea through Afghanistan, no single power will have monopoly over access. This was what Brzezinski wrote in 1997, but had outlined much earlier with the creation of the Baku-Tbilisi-Ceyhan pipeline, the BTC pipeline, that was funded and created through world financial institutions, promoted, most importantly, by the Clinton administration. Ralph?
Brzezinski, quote, "The last decade of the 20th century has witnessed a tectonic shift in world affairs. For the first time ever, a non-Eurasian power has emerged, not only as a key arbiter of Eurasian power relations, but also as the world's paramount power. The defeat and collapse of the Soviet Union was the final step in the rapid ascendance of a Western Hemisphere power, the United States, as the sole and indeed the first truly global power. It is imperative," he continues, "that no Eurasian challenger emerges capable of dominating Europe and of challenging America, and the formulation of a comprehensive and integrated Eurasian strategy is the fundamental purpose of this book." And he continues, "Two basic steps are thus required. First, to identify the geostrategically dynamic Eurasian states that have the power to cause a potentially important shift in the international distribution of power, and to decipher the central external goals of their respective political elites and the likely consequences of their seeking to attain them. Second, to formulate specific U.S. policies to offset, co-opt, and control the above. To put it in terminology that harkens back to the more brutal age of ancient empires, the three grand imperatives of our imperial geostrategy are to prevent collusion and maintain security, dependence among the vassals, keep the tributaries pliant, and keep the barbarians from coming together. The United States will determine how to cope with regional coalitions that might push America out of Eurasia, thereby threatening America's status as the global power." It's interesting that he cites Uzbekistan, the most vital and the most populous of the Central Asian states and representing the major obstacle to any renewed Russian control over the region. And he writes, "Its role is critical to the survival of the other Central Asian states, and it is the least vulnerable to Russian pressures." And then he continues, "The world's energy consumption is bound to increase vastly over the next three decades. Estimates by the U.S. Department of Energy anticipate that demand in the world will rise over 50% between 1993 and 2015, with the most significant increase in consumption occurring in the Far East." And he then makes the following statement, "Uzbekistan is the prime candidate for regional leadership in Central Asia." Brothers and sisters, do you know what kind of leadership the Brzezinskis and the American imperialists and the CIA imposed? The British ambassador made a passionate personal declaration that opponents of the regime in Uzbekistan were physically boiled alive in boiling water, that torture and dismemberment and disfigurement was the constant of the police apparatus set up in the Uzbekistan with the help of the United States. He broke ranks. He exposed. That is the reality on the ground of these high-flown geostrategic fulminations of the likes of Brzezinski. It is torment. It is torture. It is ruthless exploitation. It is neo-starvation conditions for the mass of the population and constant military confrontation, intrigue, and death and destruction on the ground.
Ralph, death and destruction. And he does this with a cold, calculating presentation. When he talks about the breakup of the Soviet Union in the few weeks of December 1991, he points to the fact that Russia's Asian space suddenly shrank by about 20%, and the population Russia controlled in Asia was cut from 75 million to 30 million people. In addition, another 18 million residents in the Caucasus were detached. This is the breakup of the Soviet Union in December 1991. And let's go now to what Brzezinski did as a prime mover and shaker within the administrations, because he states, the Soviet Union was defying the reality of national aspirations that were embraced by half its people who were not true rulers in their own countries, and that eventually the Soviet Union would collapse. This is what he stated as a student 40 years ago, and I'm reading from the keynote address that Brzezinski gave at a conference entitled The Caucasus, Choosing Conciliation Over Confrontation, sponsored by the U.S. Azerbaijan Chamber of Commerce, March 26, 1997. What Brzezinski goes on to talk about in this keynote address is revealing his role in the breakup of the Soviet Union. He says that he proposed an initiative to advance the process of what might be called, quote, peaceful change within the Soviet Union. Peaceful change? This is what was done. Specifically, the U.S. government assisted so-called national movements within the various, what he calls so-called Soviet republics. These were the Soviet republics, because that's what the USSR is. It's the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics that assisted national movements in developing greater possibilities to express their national aspiration. This enabled internal pressures to build up and surface. And indeed, when the Soviet Union started to undertake serious reforms, it became evident that reform would be impossible because national aspirations pointed not in the direction of reform of the Soviet Union, but in the direction of dismantling it. Let's really look at what he's talking about when he says assisting national movements in creating pressure, internal pressures that would build up and surface and lead to the dismantling of the USSR. Ralph?
That is exactly what he meant by the Great Bear Trap. This so-called assisting national movements is what he did in Afghanistan, what the Central Intelligence Agency and Brzezinski contrived, namely the setting up of terror apparatus, Osama bin Laden, Gulbuddin Hekmatyar. What had first been disclosed as what was considered then a revelation of $6 billion assigned to these people for this purpose. What General Gulhamid, the head of the ISI, confirmed to me was, as he put it to me, $50 billion, my dear sir. And one of the things that was so important about one of the key elements of this entire praxis in Afghanistan is that the operations were not only undertaken in Afghanistan, they were undertaken in all of the, what he calls, so-called Soviet republics, namely Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, Kyrgyzstan, Turkmenistan, the exact republics of the region of Central Asia that Brzezinski had targeted for dismantling.
And most importantly, Georgia and Azerbaijan, key for the creation of the BTC pipeline, an alternative oil pipeline that would allow for the transport of Central Asian oil directly to the Mediterranean via Turkey, bypassing the centralized routes that were now going through Russia.
Now consider this, because, brothers and sisters, what is the trigger point rationale for the imposition of essentially an Israeli creation and an imperial stooge in Saakashvili in Georgia? The Orange Revolution was in fact a U.S. contrivance, precisely as Brzezinski outlines. This is what he writes in 1997. Georgia, too, will remain vulnerable to external pressures which can adversely affect us over time, he writes, and he says, the viability of the surrounding area of Azerbaijan will be affected. And then he continues to state that the issue of Abkhazia must be resolved in a constructive fashion. And what are we talking about here? Precisely the resolution of Abkhazia and Ossetia. What does it mean to resolve them in a constructive fashion? We saw what it meant armed attack by Georgia, preparing to do so under the aegis of American imperialist forces, special forces, and the Israeli IDF and Mossad.
We will pause now for station identification.
Yo, this is G-Love on WBAI, New York, New York.
This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, The Grand Chessboard, 11 Years Later, Part 3, Global Hegemony and Permanent War. Ralph?
Maya, a very important interview took place with Zbigniew Brzezinski in the issue of Le Nouvel Observateur, January 15th to January 21st issue in 1998. It's extraordinarily revelatory when we look back now 10 years and see what Brzezinski was acknowledging at that time.
Ralph, this is so important that I think we should read the interview.
Let's do that, Maya. Question. The former director of the Central Intelligence Agency, Robert Gates, the current defense secretary, the author of The Surge, the key collaborator with the Democrats, the key figure in the Bush administration's Iraq policy of the moment. The former director of the CIA, Robert Gates, stated in his memoirs, From the Shadows, that American intelligence services began to aid the Mujahideen, i.e. Osama bin Laden, in Afghanistan, 6 months before Soviet intervention. In this period, Mr. Brzezinski, you were the national security advisor to President Carter. You, therefore, played the key role in this affair. Is that correct?
And Brzezinski responds, yes. According to the official version of history, CIA aid to the Mujahideen began during 1980. That is to say, after the Soviet army invaded Afghanistan on December 24, 1979. But reality, closely guarded until now, is completely otherwise, Brzezinski states. Indeed, it was July 3, 1979, that President Carter signed the first directive for secret aid to the opponents of the pro-Soviet regime in Kabul. And that very day, I wrote a note to the president in which I explained to him that, in my opinion, this aid was going to induce a Soviet military intervention.
The question is asked, despite this risk, you were an advocate of this covert operation? Perhaps you yourself desired Soviet entry into the war and looked for the opportunity to provoke it.
And Brzezinski responds, it isn't quite that. We didn't push the Russians to intervene, but we knowingly increased the probability that they would. Again, Brzezinski states, we knowingly increased the probability that they would.
The questioner says, when the Soviets justified their intervention by asserting that they were fighting against secret involvement of the United States in Afghanistan, and indeed in their own territory, people didn't believe them. However, there was a basis of truth in what they stated. You don't regret anything today? And Brzezinski states, regret what? These secret operations were an excellent idea. They had the effect of drawing the Russians into our Afghan trap. You want me to regret it? The day that the Soviets officially crossed the border in response to what we were doing, I wrote to President Carter, in substance, quote, we now have the opportunity of giving to the USSR its Vietnam War. Indeed, for almost 10 years, Moscow had to carry on a war unsupportable by the government, a conflict that brought about the demoralization and the breakup of the Soviet Union. The point here that Brzezinski is making is that they imposed a condition through the massive involvement of the Central Intelligence Agency, of the U.S. military with strategic weapons, with creating terror operations across the Soviet republics in Afghanistan, not alone, but in all of the adjacent Central Asian republics of the then Soviet Union. This is what the Nouvel Observatoire then follows up with in 1998. Neither do you regret supporting the Islamic fundamentalists giving arms and guidance to terrorists? Brzezinski. What is most important to the history of the world? The Taliban or the collapse of the Soviet Empire? Some stirred up Muslims or the liberation of Central Europe? The question, stirred up Muslims? But Islamic fundamentalism represents a world menace today. This is 1998, brothers and sisters. You get the picture here? The substitution of the menace of communism with the category of terror? Islamic fundamentalism? What Brzezinski states is our operation. What the Nouvel Observatoire says, stirred up Muslims, I repeat, Islamic fundamentalism represents a world menace today. And Brzezinski responds, nonsense. It is said that the West had a global policy in regard to Islam. That is stupid. There isn't a global Islam. Look at Islam in a rational manner and without demagogy. It is the leading religion of the world with 1.5 billion followers. What is there in common among Saudi Arabian fundamentalists, moderate Morocco, Pakistan militarism, Egyptian pro-Western, or Central Asian secularism? Nothing more than what unites the Christian countries. So what we have here, brothers and sisters, on the part of Brzezinski, is a cynical, calculated, cold-blooded revelation and acknowledgement in 1998. This was a CIA operation. This terror apparatus was funded, created, and set in motion by the Central Intelligence Agency and by Brzezinski himself. The object of the exercise was to break up the Soviet Union. The purpose was indeed to engender a terror apparatus which had nothing to do with Islam and everything to do with imperialism. The entire rationale for the war on terror, the entire justification for the Patriot Act, for the repression at home, for the torture abroad, for the expansion of military operations in what Barack Obama calls 100 countries in which the terror apparatus has to be destroyed. Brzezinski. It is a fraud, it is a contrivance, it is an engineered undertaking, it is the essence of imperialism, it is the nature of our world at this moment, it is the, in fact, content of the need to overthrow, to remove from power and from history this criminal ruling class.
What we saw in Afghanistan is the bear trap. That is what Brzezinski called entrapping the Soviet Union because he knew it would result in a Vietnam-like situation for the Soviets, the bear trap in Afghanistan. But simultaneously, as we saw in his keynote address to the U.S. Azerbaijan Chamber of Commerce, there was the funding of the bourgeois and terrorist operations within the Soviet republics under the guise of nationalist aspirations. It is using nationalism in a fake mode. It is to preserve imperial rule because, as Brzezinski states over and again in his interviews, if you break up these nations, you allow for the opportunity for the U.S. oil interests, for the U.S. corporate interests, for the U.S. armaments industry to go into these republics. This is what they are trying to do, and this is what they have achieved, yet Russia is not standing still. And that is what we are going to discuss at length in our next program of Taking Aim. But meanwhile, let's return to Brzezinski.
Well, Maya, I think it's important to clarify and to make clear here that the Soviet bureaucracy, the heirs, the epigons of Stalin, the Brezhnevs of the world, this rotten and corrupt bureaucracy that was as much in collusion with Western imperialism as it was a victim thereof, presided over subject peoples indeed, because the mobilization of working people in their own name had been liquidated by the Stalin apparatus, and it is precisely the alienation of the vast masses of people who had been involved in revolutionary upsurge throughout Central Asia at the time of the Bolshevik Revolution, who became an arena in which imperialism could play their deadly games. The apparatus of control of the Stalinist bureaucracy and its military and its repressive regime was indeed the circumstance in which the loss of any base in the public, the aspirations of people to have not merely national self-determination, but democratic control over their affairs, to have the content of the Bolshevik Revolution realized. It's like a gangster trade union bureaucracy imposing itself on the Teamsters or the Seamen's Union and making sweetheart deals over the heads of the rank and file. That was the role of the Russian bureaucracy, the Soviet bureaucracy, and it's what facilitated the objectives of imperialism. Where there is popular control, where is the democratic content of socialist revolution, imperialism cannot succeed in its plots and predations against a popular regime. The counterpart to the destruction of the Soviet Union under the apparatus of the bureaucracy was indeed the role of the bureaucracy itself, which in class terms was essentially the transmission belt of imperial hegemony and ideology within the former Soviet Union itself.
Ralph, the aspirations of the people of the Soviet Union, their aspirations were for a political revolution to complete the Bolshevik Revolution.
Yes, they didn't want to get rid of social ownership of the means of production. They didn't want to get rid of their free housing, their free health care, their subsidized education, all of the secure work that had been the fruit of the Bolshevik Revolution. They wanted to get rid of corrupt and dictatorial oligarchs, symbolized, by the way, by Putin, who was the head of the KGB at the time. Nonetheless, from the point of view of imperialism, it could care less about the absence of democratic content on the part of the Soviet bureaucracy. Its objective was to destroy any impediment to imperial control of the regions of the world, as Brzezinski articulates and outlines. The object of the exercise is subjugation, and the game that is played is to invoke the categories of self-determination for their opposite. Imperialism is a lying hegemon. It is a deceitful ideological falsification of the realities of the governance on the ground, and above all, the meaning of imperial plots for the population themselves. No sooner do they assist or contrive the elimination of any obstacle regime do they impose the most ruthless and exploitative substitute. The only difference is that it is completely under the hegemony of U.S. imperialism itself.
Ralph, the name of the game is control of resources, control of people to acquire these resources. The main game, over and again, as Brzezinski states, for the push of world power is oil, gas, and minerals such as gold. This is what, over and again, he writes, how can we get the oil and gas? How can we transport it? What nations are necessary to create and to control? And this is important. And this is how Saakashvili got in power, with the U.S. support through his Rose Revolution.
Well, you see it very clearly, Maya, in the interview that Brzezinski gave to the Azerbaijan International publication in the spring of 2000. And the interview was entitled, Geopolitically Speaking, Russia's Sphere of Influence, Chechnya and beyond. And he writes, 5 years ago I went to Baku and I delivered a letter to President Aliyev on behalf of President Clinton. We had a late-night discussion that lasted several hours. It resulted in a historical decision being made that weekend by President Aliyev. The decision was that Azerbaijan would not allow itself to be dependent on any single line of access to the rest of the world. Specifically, it meant Azerbaijan would develop alternative pipeline routes that would not access Russia and would not go via Russia to the Black Sea port at Novorossiysk. Azerbaijan would develop multiple access to the rest of the world, notably a western route through Georgia to the Black Sea at Supsa. This was a historic decision significant to the future of Azerbaijan and to the region. Since 1995, American policy has been committed to the idea of geopolitical pluralism. That means that there will be access to the region that will be the result of America's strong support. And we will support the independence of Ukraine, Georgia, Azerbaijan, as well as other states in order to facilitate pipelines that do not go through the former Soviet Union. This is a major strategic shift in American policy that took place in 1994. Up till then, the U.S. had been inclined to place emphasis on its relationship with Russia and to define that relationship as the central and most important strategic relationship. That policy was altered. The Baku-Supsa pipeline, the pipeline west from Baku to Georgia's Black Sea, has become reality. This route reflects the strategic commitment to a concept of participation in the prosperity and stability of the region, he writes. In other words, brothers and sisters, it is an imperial project to subordinate Russia from access for the outlet of oil and gas reserves, and to prepare not merely for the control of the access of oil and gas of the region, but for the further breakup of Russia itself. The operation in Georgia, as he stipulates right here in the year 2000, was a central piece of this, and he writes, joint recognition that Azerbaijan, under your leadership, and Georgia are vital to regional stability. The United States has a direct national interest in this. Therefore, let me join in this toast to the security of Azerbaijan. That's Brzezinski, 2000, describing his machinations of the grand chessboard, the implementation on the ground, the very operation that we have been describing in Georgia, articulated by Brzezinski in relation to both Azerbaijan and Georgia in the spring of 2000.
This statement, this policy, is backed up by the neocons Ariel Cohn and Ian Bremmer. In 1997, in Backgrounder 1132, Ariel Cohn writes, this is July 24, 1997, U.S. policy in the Caucasus and Central Asia. He states explicitly, quote, we must make the region more receptive to oil-driven investment from the West. He details in particular what he calls the New Silk Road. Commerce along the Silk Road, which was a network of caravan routes running from China and India through Central Asia to Western Europe. And he discusses the New Silk Road, which is the pipelines, the oil and gas pipelines, which would go through the Caucasus to Central Asia. And it would make a New Silk Road a trade and investment engine to power unprecedented economic growth. Economic growth, imperial wealth. He says the Silk Road would connect China, Russia, Eurasia, and Western Europe, providing business opportunities for American companies. The future of the Silk Road is therefore an important national interest. Key to the Silk Road for Ariel Cohn, for Ian Bremmer, for Zbigniew Brzezinski is the breakup of the Soviet Union, for the control of the former Soviet republics, for the expansion of NATO, for surrounding Russia with American military might. Ralph?
Ariel Cohn, on July 24, 1997, is very clear. The Caspian Sea reserves are estimated to hold 100 billion to 200 billion barrels of oil worth $4 trillion at current market prices. $4 trillion at current market prices in 1997, brothers and sisters, when oil was one-tenth of the cost that it is today, we're talking $40 trillion. This is the magnitude of rapine exploitation that they have designed. He said it is linked to other important U.S. geostrategic interests in Eurasia. U.S. policymakers are increasingly concerned about the reemergence of a new Russian empire, and they realize that ready access to the rich oil and gas resources of this region could fuel such an expansion. A new Russian empire will seek to gain control over the region's pipelines and limit U.S. access. Furthermore, the radical Islamic regime in Iran could move to turn Central Asia into its strategic rear as a potential sphere of influence. Even China has the potential to become involved. The U.S. has the overarching interest in arranging the economic prosperity of Southern Caucasus and Central Asia under the hegemony of the United States. The United States has many reasons to contribute to the revival of this region by participating in the development of an extensive network of pipelines, railroads, highways, ports, airports, and telecommunications that can serve as the Silk Road to link the U.S. to the East in the third millennium. Brothers and sisters, the articulation of imperial strategy is constant. It is detailed. It is overwhelmingly explicit. It isn't Ariel Cohn or Brzezinski alone. It is every think tank. It is every major spokesperson for capital. It is a virtual Mein Kampf, not merely of the events of Georgia, but the preparations for a new global-scale confrontation with Russia and China themselves.
And Ralph, key to this is privatization, what they call market reform, overturning the gains of the Russian Revolution. As Ariel Cohn states, restructure U.S. and multilateral assistance to countries in Central Asia and the Southern Caucasus. The United States should focus on providing assistance for implementing market reforms, encouraging industrial and agricultural privatization, developing the rule of law, creating functioning legal systems, boosting educational exchange, and strengthening civic society. Its Silk Road strategy should include diplomatic cooperation as well as military security and political support for the countries of the southern tier, especially countries like Azerbaijan and Georgia. This would allow American companies to develop the region's natural resources. It would help secure the sovereignty and foster pro-American, pro-Western orientations in Georgia, Azerbaijan, Armenia, and other countries in the region. They are clear. And Ariel Cohn says that a nonprofit foundation should be set up to coordinate such efforts. In other words, creating a separation from the U.S. State Department itself, much in the way is being done in Iran, has been done in all the countries that they try to undermine. Brzezinski himself is more overt. It's not just through nonprofit foundations. As Brzezinski stated in those interviews, it is through the Central Intelligence Agency itself. Go in, stir up, destroy the infrastructure and the stability, and also subjugate the peoples of the region.
Well, Maya, we have been describing the 30-year preparation for these operations in Central Asia to seize the resources, to fund, in fact, what became the terror apparatus of Osama bin Laden and Gulbuddin Hekmatyar. I want to mention not only that, and we will return to this in future programs, brothers and sisters, because we've only just scratched the surface of these articulations in journal after journal, in strategic publication after publication. But this current crisis in Georgia has been subject to a coordinated campaign in the Los Angeles Times, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, the Times of London, in all the major outlets. Stand up to Russia, writes Max Boot. It took the Russian army only 2 days to secure Abkhazia and South Ossetia. Now Russia is pressing its attacks into the heart of Georgia, threatening to cut vital oil pipelines. And he goes into great detail about the necessity for the United States to use military means to secure them. Who is coordinating this campaign in the press, brothers and sisters? It is the Benador Associates, which is the far-right neocon public relations apparatus and operation that has called for the removal of formal democratic institutions within the United States itself, which has articulated the necessity to impose what amounts to military rule to sustain these policies. That is the underlying predicate of this grand adventure for which the preparations have been made by the Brzezinskis of this world, no less than Joe Biden or Barack Obama, the current mouthpieces for this ruling class. Those are the stakes. That is what is unfolding before our eyes. We will continue to describe it and to document it and to amplify this as we go on with this series on Taking Aim.
This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, The Grand Chessboard, 11 Years Later, Part 3, Global Hegemony and Permanent War, will be on our website, www.takingaimradio.com. Please contact us at takingaim@pacbell.net. We'll be with you next week.
This is the professor, Dr. Ron Daniels, host of Night Talk, inviting you to attend an extraordinary forum sponsored by the Institute of the Black World.